Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Josh Stearns from Free Press, Patrick Ruffini from Engage, Evan Brown, and me. We're going to talk about the TPP. It leaked this week, finally. We'll talk about the content and the journalistic ramifications of that. Over at Free Press, Josh and his colleagues are paying attention to all kinds of interesting issues around journalism, including when journalists can be held criminally liable for their content. We'll go deep on that. Plus, there's a new victory in Google's favor in the book search case. Lots more, too, next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 236, recorded November 15, 2013. Sounds European. Hey, folks. You're tuning in for This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, and we've got a fantastic panel joining us today and some really important and timely topics that I think you're going to find really interesting. To shed their insights on those topics, we have Josh Stearns joining us. He is the public media campaign director for Free Press and definitely an advocate for all things related to freedom of the press. Great to have you on the show, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
It's fantastic to get the opportunity to chat with you. Lots of good timely things happening and important things happening in your area of the of expertise. Can you tell us a bit about Free Press so people know if they haven't heard of the organization, what you guys do?
Sure. We're a national nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. We've got about 650,000 members around the country, and we work on protecting everyone's right to connect and communicate. So for us, that means working on issues like internet freedom, as well as press freedom, but then a range of other issues underneath that big umbrella, things like media consolidation, public broadcasting, journalism issues, in terms of nonprofit journalism, and especially to a range of issues related to how we are able to use the internet and the devices that we own.
And Josh, where are you located geographically?
I'm based here in Western Massachusetts, actually, but we also have a DC office.
Got it. Well, also joining us from that part of the world, from DC, is Patrick Ruffini. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Denise. Good to be here.
Great to see you. Patrick is the president of a firm called Engage, and I'm trying to wrap my head around, it seems like you guys do mostly consulting on digital strategy for people in the political arena. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm trying to wrap my head around it too some days. there's a lot of different things going on, but we've been in digital politics for a number of years. And so, and I think we like to think of ourselves as kind of a tiny outpost of innovation in the otherwise staid and risk-averse world of Washington. What do we do day to day? I mean, you kind of run technology and advocacy campaigns for political parties, candidates, foundation. So, but a lot of that work in recent years has focused a lot on innovation and disruption and helping innovators get their story told in Washington, D.C. And that really started for us in a big way as a big part of what we do around SOPA PIPA when we were one of the first groups to get involved with that. My background has been sort of in center right Republican politics, and that's pretty rare these days, I think, for somebody who speak out on issues like internet freedom, even on the business side of things, even on talking about how technology is disrupting markets. We think that's sort of a natural thing for conservatives to talk about, but yet there haven't been that many people talking about it. So we like to talk about it in addition to focusing a lot of our work on supporting that.
Great. Well, we certainly have lots of interesting things to discuss with you as well today. But before we jump into all that, welcoming back to the show, my co-host Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Hope your Friday's going well. It's great to be here.
Great to see you again. How are things in Chicago?
Can't complain. You know, it's getting to be winter time. It's good. You know, it's, you know, lots of cool things going on. So, yeah, it's, but, you know, the best part of it is hanging out here on a Friday afternoon on Twill.
Yes. And just to get it out of the way for our video viewers who see your new pennant behind you, what's that all about?
That's my alma mater, Wabash College in Crawfordsville, Indiana. And this weekend is the 120th Monon Bell game. Every year Wabash plays DePauw University. It's the oldest athletic rivalry west of the Alleghenies. So, you know, lots of anticipation for that. I won't be going down to the game, but I'm watching it from a telecast party up here in the Chicago suburbs. But it's a great time, really interesting, interesting on a sociological level as well. You know, this rivalry, it's Division III football. So it's, you know, there's a lot to be taken seriously about there. But, you know, so it goes deep into, you know, college nostalgia and stuff like that. So looking forward to that tomorrow.
Sounds really fun. All right. Well, from nostalgia to policy, let's talk about some things that have been going on in D.C. One thing that we have been anxiously awaiting, and it seems like it has taken a long time, is for someone to leak the details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We have talked about that treaty on the show before, proposed treaty. We've had people speculating on what was going to be in its intellectual property provisions. Those were just leaked to WikiLeaks this week. And now we have some idea, and as suspected, doesn't look good. Evan, have you looked very closely at this chapter that came out a couple days ago?
Well, I've skimmed through it. It's 95 pages, and I've had other things to do this week besides read it. I've left that to the smart people who, you know, analyze this stuff. But, you know, I think, first of all, you know, for framing this discussion about the TPP, I think, you know, regardless of what you think of the substantive issues, and that's really where the discussion is, you know, the idea of copyright term extension, the draconian ISP liability, and the extension of the anti-circumvention provisions on a global level, you know, the substantive things about it, wherever you come down on those issues, on the side of big content or the individual user innovator, what have you, it's just crazy that this negotiation of an important treaty like this that could affect anywhere between 40 and 60% of the world's global economy is being done in such a secretive way. And this issue is nothing new. I mean, we've complained about this lack of transparency several different times in several different iterations, you know, with the different treaties and different types of organizations. What was the one that involved Europe that everybody got so upset about, especially in Poland, you know, and eventually we got out, kind of extricated from that. So, I mean, it's just crazy. It's insane that this is being done in so much secrecy. And it appears more, unfortunately, to be part of an epidemic on how governments are doing things. And I'm not just pointing the blame at the U.S. government on its lack of transparency on this. All the countries who are involved in this ought to be upset with their governments for insisting on it being done in so much secrecy. So that's my commentary on how we should frame the issue. And then there's plenty to talk about, you know, in the substance as well that we can kind of unpack as part of the conversation.
Well, and lots of the law professors that we've had on the show, you were just telling me before we started recording, are in the same camp with you, Evan. They think that we definitely need to open up this process and have sent a letter to the president, members of Congress, and Ambassador Michael Froman asking for the light to be shined on both the process and the content of the TPP. David Levine, first signatory to this letter, and 80 other law professors have come together and said, we really need to know what's going on here. Do you think that will have an impact?
Well, let's hope. I mean, that's certainly significant that 80 law professors would sign into that, you know, and they share the sensibility, I think, of just about anyone. I can't imagine that the overall level of trust in the government to do the right thing in the interest of the people has ever been at a lower point in the history of humankind. I mean, I don't know. How would you do empirical studies on that? Who knows? But, you know, I'm seeing people in IRC express this sentiment. And, you know, Virgil, for example, just says if they have to talk about it in secret, it can't be any good for the people. So I hope that, you know, the president, the administration, and, you know, the leaders of the other governments around the world would recognize this, that if you're going to live in a world where WikiLeaks exist, you're not going to be able to keep things in secret ultimately. So why make it worse by at least even trying to have this transparent or this opaqueness? Because it's not going to work in the world that the way it is, and people are going to be so incredulous about the efforts that are going on. So you know, I can only be optimistic that it will help. Certainly governments react, historically have reacted to outcry over things. Look at the SOPA and the PIPA issues. And of course, I'm the least well qualified of anybody in this conversation to talk about the dynamics behind that. But you know, let's hope that this is one thing that goes in that direction.
Well, Patrick, you're definitely qualified to talk about the dynamics behind that. You edited the Hacking Politics book, How Geeks, Progressives, the Tea Party, Gamers, Anarchists, and Suits Teamed Up to Defeat SOPA and Save the Internet. Do you think that now that we have the text of the TPP becoming more available, that we'll see a similar movement here?
Possibly. I mean, I think it's interesting, and oftentimes these negotiations have been taking place for years and years. I mean, there was a leak in February of 2011 about this, and that happened long before SOPA and PIPA. ACTA was the treaty Evan was referring to, which was another one of these things that you know, was kind of viewed as kind of a slam dunk for the content industry, and was signed by the U.S. 3 months before SOPA and PIPA happened. And then all of a sudden, on the actual day of the internet blackout, you had votes in various European parliaments. And within those 2 days, the fight just completely turned around. But it's important to note this process has been going on for years and years with TPP. I mean, it can take 6 or 7 years of these secret negotiating rounds to actually get one of these agreements, you know, in front of the legislative bodies of these different countries. And what's interesting is think about how much technology has changed and think about how much public norms have changed in that period of time around issues like copyright. What's really striking in this leak is how much this contradicts what the U.S. is either already doing or says or is seriously considering doing, especially on patent reform. This undermines patent reform. This would undermine potentially copyright reform. You know, I know a previous guest on your show, Derek Khanna, has worked on the issue of cell phone unlocking. And while this doesn't ban cell phone unlocking outright, it does ban jailbreaking, which, you know, is currently being considered in the Massey-Lofgren bill. And it also undermines to a degree, I think, these rollbacks of, you know, kind of the aggressive DRM, you know, aggressive enforcement around DRM. You know, contradicts to some degree the new FCC chairman who says that, you know, we're going to legalize cell phone unlocking. So, yeah, I think I don't think the USTR's office has necessarily gotten the memo from SOPA and PIPA. And that's sort of been the pattern, I think, in the past around, you know, you see these disruptions in the congressional policymaking process, and now you have PTSD on the Hill about don't get SOPA again, let's not do that again. But that message isn't universally delivered. You know, particularly with trade negotiations, it's still very much captive to the industries that are most heavily driven by IP.
Yeah, Derek actually emailed before the show cautioning that very thing, that the proposed treaty would make unlocking, jailbreaking, and accessibility technology permanently illegal and remove the existing potential exemption process as well. So there's a lot to be concerned about here. One thing that doesn't seem to be of concern to any of us so far is the fact that this information was leaked. The sentiment I'm gleaning from you all is that, yes, we need more transparency around this process and that this is a valid journalistic use of WikiLeaks. So this one is not quite as much a close call as some of the other purposes that we've seen WikiLeaks used for. Josh, do you have any thoughts on the journalism side of this?
Yeah, I think that's right. This is one of those situations where it's pretty clear, both from members of Congress all the way down to individual citizens and lawyers and journalists who are demanding some more transparency here. And WikiLeaks was able to provide that. And it's really in the public interest that they did that. So I think that this really is a clear-cut case. And I actually think that what we're seeing is that journalism organizations are realizing that in a state of surveillance and a state of eroding transparency, they're depending on leaks more and more. So I'm part of a board of directors for the Freedom of the Press Foundation, and we've just released a project called SecureDrop, which was originally coded by the late Aaron Schwartz, and it is essentially a homegrown WikiLeaks that news organizations can put on their site that allows for secure, anonymous communication with sources. We're seeing a huge pickup from that. We've got a number of news organizations, mainstream news organizations and independents, who are very eager to install that so that they can begin to control some of this and offer people a place where they can go on their website to safely communicate. So I think that this is an example of why that kind of leaking is important.
All right. Well, I for one, am glad that we have the information out there and that it can be reviewed, and now there can start to be some advocacy around at least these particular provisions of the TPP, because it sounds like they are restrictive in ways that a lot of people are going to be upset about, particularly on the patent front, as Patrick was saying. Any other particular points that hit you as you read through the leaked information, Patrick?
To me, it's interesting in that, patents and copyright, are certainly two that stand out. And particularly, it does create a precedent, actually. I mean, we mentioned SOPA. It does create a precedent for that exact type of process to occur where, internet service providers are liable for infringing content posted on their servers. And that wouldn't just be the case in the United States. It would be the case in the 12 countries in the TPP. And it will obviously be interesting to see the political ramifications of this. We spend a lot of time thinking, not just from a policy standpoint. I would say we spend probably possibly even more of our time thinking about how the whole process basically of how the Schoolhouse Rock cartoon of how does a bill become a law in modern Washington. And what we're seeing right now is you've already had over 170 members of Congress sign a letter opposing Fast Track or Trade Promotion Authority for the TPP. Now, if you actually drill down on that, that's been sort of cited as a point against its passage. But you actually look at the coalition there, it's 150 Democrats and about 20 Republicans. And that's about the coalition you would see on most trade agreements. The Obama administration has not necessarily had a great track record of getting these trade agreements through Congress. Like most other things, they've kind of ground to a halt. But what's interesting is that in the past, we've seen extremely close votes in the House on renewing trade promotion authority, renewing the ability essentially for these bills to sail through without any amendment or without any ability to filibuster them. Or else, you'd kind of have to go back to the negotiating table. If you can add on top of that, there was 212 votes last time to stop trade promotion authority. If you add on top of that, that natural resistance to just trade agreements in general, just voices from the innovation community, from the technology community, and frankly, constituents potentially calling Congress saying TPP might shut down the internet, you could see this thing change very quickly, and you could see it's already a tough slog, I think, to get it through as it stands. What happens if this becomes even further inflamed, and these leaks sort of portend what's actually going to come out in the agreement.
Virgil in IRC is pointing out that Professor Michael Geist in Canada has lots of good posts up on his blog, one just from today on the IP chapter leaks. It seems like he's going through the provisions and posting up his thoughts sort of as they come to him and as he's had them gel together. So he's writing about internet service provider liability, the Canadian anti-counterfeiting bill, a conflict on geographical indications. So lots of good information over there. Thank you, Virgil, for pointing that out. Let's move on to something else on the transparency front, not so much with regard to trade agreements, but with regard to surveillance this time, the USA Freedom Act that is pending in D.C. right now. I don't know if you guys caught our November 1st show when we had Larry Downs on, but Larry was very pessimistic about any of the pending legislation around transparency making its way to any kind of final form or law going through that I'm just a bill process. He thinks they're just going to stay bills at this point. But Josh, what do you think of the USA Freedom Act and what does it mean from the journalist and free press standpoint?
Well, the bill is actually a really great starting point, but I would say it is a starting point. And you know, I think it does a couple of things that are really important. It puts some limits on the FISA court, adds some transparency there. It puts a public advocate in place so that it's not just the government arguing its own position, but we actually have someone presenting another opinion. So it does some of these sort of base level improvements that I really do think are in the public interest. And they are things in addition that that I think will help in terms of journalists' concerns about mass surveillance. And I don't know if you've read, but there's a great piece I suggest people read from the Tau Center for Digital Journalism, where Columbia professors and MIT professors came together to talk about the incongruencies with mass surveillance and the First Amendment. So, you know, I think it's a good starting point. And I actually do think right now we've got some really good traction. We just had 3,000 people descend on Washington, D.C., and a broad, diverse coalition across the political spectrum, very much in some ways similar to the SOPA coalition that emerged earlier. So I think we see traction on both sides of the aisle. We're starting to see a sense that even the longtime defenders of the NSA are realizing that we do need some reforms. And this bill may be palpable enough to start moving through the process. So I'm hopeful in that regard, but I also don't think that this solves all the problems. There's still a lot left undone.
What do you think, Patrick? Do you agree with Larry that this stuff is just kind of stalled at this point?
I think so. I mean, I think that that has generally been, I think, the pattern recently. I mean, I think, however, I mean, I think if there were to be an issue in which something were to move through, I mean, this should be the one. But, you know, I would agree with Josh. I think there is momentum on, and particularly when you have John McCain, who's certainly, you know, not necessarily known as a civil libertarian, very much of a national security hawk, calling for the resignation of, you know, General Alexander. At the NSA, I think that there is pretty growing kind of bipartisan concern around these issues. But we've already seen in the past how, you know, votes, particularly on the Amash Amendment and things like that, have not necessarily turned out well to date. So, you know, I think one of the things, I mean, I think fundamentally, I mean, we're going to be talking about, you know, from a security standpoint and from a technology standpoint, how do we thwart these types of mass surveillance efforts? As sort of, I think those are the arenas in which we're going to be talking about more and more how to actually stop this, as opposed to waiting for Congress to act. You know, it's not necessarily an issue I've followed extremely closely, but I think that's where it's going.
Evan, are you for? Do you have any opinion on this bill? Would you like to see it pass, or do you think it is taking it too far and possibly impairing the ability of the NSA to do its job?
Well, you know, I don't want to really say anything at all about it because I just don't feel qualified understanding the nuances of it all. Because, you know, there's never been an issue when it comes to these topics more sophisticated, more complex than what it is now in the way that we balance privacy and civil liberties with the national security interests. So, you know, when it comes to this, I like to do more listening than talking when it comes to solving this problem. I can, you know, ask the questions and think about it as well. But, you know, I kind of, you know, back way out of this and look at it at a much more of a macro level and present fundamental questions about, you know, how government is supposed to handle these issues, really, because, you know, if you look at the history of our country, there have always been complicated issues to solve and things that put our country and our Western society, you know, Western civilization at an existential threat. You know, wars is the big one, you know, economic crises for another one. I mean, look, you know, just look at the first half of the 20th century, you had the Great Depression and World War II, and among other things, I guess two world wars actually in the first half of the 20th century. So, I mean, there's never been a time where there hasn't been a lot of stuff to think about. But I would also submit that these problems are always becoming more and more nuanced, much more complex because of the number of parties involved, the dollar figures that are involved. So, you know, when is it going to we're looking at the question of the government's bandwidth, right? Isn't that what started our discussion about this? Larry Down said, you know, the government's too busy, won't be able to do anything until the budget crisis gets resolved. I think that's what he attributed it to. Notwithstanding the healthcare issue, the Obamacare issues that are going on now. So when will it be that the society that we have is going to become too complex for a bicameral legislator and a tripartite government with one executive to handle? You know, when is it going to melt the system down? That's the question that I would kind of just, you know, introduce into the ether without more as a rhetorical question than one to seriously try to unpack. So
Great question and a great thing to consider. I think it also makes a great MCLE passphrase for this episode of the show, bicameral and tripartite. If you're listening to the show for continuing legal education or other professional credit, we drop these phrases into the show so that you can demonstrate that you actually listened or watched, however you are consuming it. So bicameral and tripartite will be our first one. And I want to throw something that's been on my mind as I've caught up on the first several episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on ABC. I know you're wondering how I'm going to tie that into this conversation, but I've found it really fascinating that in this very sort of lighthearted, you know, popcorn munching evening entertainment with strong superhero and supernatural overtones, how they're able to work in a lot of themes. The writing is excellent, coming from Joss Whedon and I'm assuming his son, Jed, and others. They're able to work in a lot of what we're talking about right now. You know, the ethics of surveillance and the ethics of hacktivism on the other side, and you know, how much is too far in both directions, and what's you know, overall the best thing for society. You know, how much of each are we willing to accept? And it's been interesting for me to see that, you know, playing out in primetime and teeing up, you know, family conversations on these topics that, you know, otherwise I don't think we would ever have gotten into. And I'm wondering if that's happening in other households around this show. Have you guys been watching, and do you think that it might contribute to the national dialogue on these important issues? What do you think, Josh?
I haven't been watching the show, although I am very interested in it. I will say, though, that both to your point and to Evan's point, we're in such early days still in what we know about this issue. You know, to Evan's point, this is a really complex issue, and we have only known what we know about 6 months now, was when the, you know, first revelation started coming out. And each week we get something new, a new technical protocol, a new program, a new set of issues that we need to grapple with. And so we are very much still in the early days, and we still have a lot of debate and learning to do as a society in terms of having these debates about the balance between security and privacy. And so I think that I'm encouraged by how many people want to have that debate, the fact that 3,000 people turned out in Washington, D.C., the fact that 500,000 people signed a petition at stopwatching.us. And even since the bill has been introduced, we've had 30,000 people take action here at freepress.net. So those are all encouraging factors. But I think to your point about culture, the fact that this is getting into culture is key. There's a great cultural critic named Jeff Chang who says that culture change always precedes policy change. It's the dress rehearsal for policy change. And I really like that because I think where we battle these ideas out through culture and how that culture kind of trickles down into our living rooms and our dining room tables, that helps set the stage for the political change that will come later on.
Yeah, I think so too. What do you think, Patrick?
I haven't been watching the show, but I was thinking about it this week, and it seems like the it's just kind of like the TPP, where like this, we've had examples of this process playing out before, and all of a sudden we have to ask what's different now. And I think what's different now is people are actually living their lives online more and more. I mean, we've had we had a big a similar national security leak in 2005 and 2006 with the revelations about wiretapping. And I don't think that the reaction to that was quite as fervent as what we've seen now, is because, I mean, now everybody's using Gmail. Everyone's using some sort of cloud service. And I think people are thinking about that a lot more, and particularly, you know, as certainly as, you know, national security and terrorism, which was a big issue, a really huge issue at the time, you know, fades a little bit more into the background. And you have, I think, people much more conscious of their online rights and the sense that this could actually affect me. I think that that, as a cultural factor in and of itself, has changed the tenor of a lot of these debates.
All right. Well, the chat room is correcting me and letting me know that Jed Whedon is Joss Whedon's brother and that there's a sister-in-law involved on the writing team, too. That's interesting. They're keeping it in the family. Evan, have you watched the show at all?
No, I haven't. But, you know, the conversation is leading me to think about the singularity. I think that's before we actually...
you know, everything leads you to think about the singularity.
Right. Well, isn't it all going there? you know, I think there's before we started recording on the show here, we were talking about the singularity. But I mean, the web is only like 8,100 days old, you know, however many days it was to August 6th, 1991, you know, when the World Wide Web began. And the growth has been exponential. I mean, things have happened in that 22 years that we wouldn't have ever expected. And it took a long time for people to even start using the web and you know, to really start making fundamental changes in the way that we communicate and we, you know, do the things that we do. And so I think that we've probably had a hard time keeping up when it deals with our sensibilities and our sense of privacy and all of that. And, you know, we've been kicking it around on the show for years and years. Oh, there's this problem, for example, of our right of privacy in information that's stored on a third party server. And, you know, there's this third party doctrine that presents problems under the Fourth Amendment. You know, we cognitively know that, but I don't know that we've really gotten it into our minds and in our hearts, you know, to be concerned about these things. And so the sensibilities that we become concerned about and that we find a fuller expression in these examples of the show that you're talking about here, you know, kind of just are all of a process of helping us keep up. We perceive progress as linear, but really it's happening exponentially. And so there's that stress that we feel when we're trying to figure out how to conduct ourselves in this world that we have and which continues to grow in complexity.
Yes, it certainly does. And well, you're considering how relatively young things are. There was an interesting email to Brett Baier at Fox News. One of their listeners, viewers, emailed in noticing that the U.S. involvement in World War II was actually longer than the time that the administration has had to work on and launch healthcare.gov. And he notes the mobilization of millions, building tens of thousands of tanks, planes, jeeps, subs, cruisers, destroyers, torpedoes, millions and millions of guns, bombs, ammo, etc., turning the tide in North Africa, invading Italy, D-Day, blah, blah, blah. All of that happened in less time than actually the prep time for healthcare.gov. And still, as we've mentioned, alluded to on the show already, that hasn't been going very well. And I encourage people, if you've not listened to the most recent episode of TWiT, to catch up. This is a good, I think, follow-on discussion to that. They had Harper Reed on, who was instrumental in the digital strategy for the Obama campaign, but had no involvement in the healthcare.gov site. And he had a good discussion with the panel on TWiT about sort of debunking the myth of, oh, you know, if only he and other really good Silicon Valley technologists had been involved, then we wouldn't be in this situation.
He's from Chicago. He's not, I mean, there is the Silicon Valley, but Harper Reed is Chicago. So go on.
There we go. Good clarification. Glad to know that. Brilliant guy, obviously. Where he went with this is to this whole procurement issue. And that is something that Patrick has written about in detail recently, and I think would probably be happy to kind of explain and walk us through for anyone who doesn't understand, and I'll put myself in that boat, you know, what the real problem, the real hurdle is, and how there might be a path to solving it. Can you talk about that for us in 1 second, Patrick? Before you do that, I'd love to also show, if we can, the photo, and I should have given Alex in the studio the heads up for this earlier, that you posted. You had a big sign in your office in DC about healthcare.gov, didn't you, Patrick?
So Engage is located strategically on a block with about five pubs, appropriately. And this week, President Obama and Vice President Biden, I suspect that the Vice President's recommendation, decided to have lunch at one of these places. We're also next door to a Marine facility. And so just having lunch with some of the service members. And we noticed a bunch of limousines outside our window and a bunch of motorcade. At first, we didn't think that much of it. I mean, come on, this is in D.C. This happens in D.C. all the time. Motorcades galore. But then we noticed this one was really, really long, as in stretched around the block long. And we have a pretty long block around here. So it turns out the president and vice president were having lunch. And we decided to just say, you know, if he wants to come up, we build websites. They usually work. They work pretty much 100% of the time. Oh, I'm not going to raise expectations that high. If he wants to come up and get some pointers on healthcare.gov, he's more than welcome to do that while he's in the neighborhood. But seriously, I think that there's been a lot of serious discussion. I mean, this is obviously a debate that's, become a much larger political discussion right now. What a lot of very smart people like Clay Johnson, who worked on as a technologist in President Obama's first campaign and is now working on fixing this mess with procurement, they have really looked at something called the Federal Acquisition Regulation, which is what governs all of these IT projects. IT in the federal government is a massive $80 billion a year project. I mean, it's something that, and the projects themselves are really huge. The regulation as a result, which is designed, again, to ostensibly stop cronyism, stop corruption, has really blocked out all but the largest, most well-connected vendors out there. And the regulation itself is 2,000 pages long, 2,000 pages of requirements that businesses need to meet. It's administered in part by the Secretary of Defense and the NASA administrator. So it's not surprising. This was a system that was designed for procuring weapon systems and space shuttles and not websites. And as a result, you know, a lot of the big IT, quote unquote IT vendors, and I use the quotes on that, are really defense contractors who've opened up IT divisions because the defense contractors know how to work the system. If you go to the Capital South Metro station in D.C., half of the ads up there are for various weapon systems. And why would we want to do that? Because there is a very highly politicized process for getting government contracts. And that's what happened in this case. In fact, the contract, as they say, was kind of greased because there was an existing contract and they just shoehorned in CGI Federal. So you really have these big lumbering federal IT contractors getting the work. And it's not really a good fit for, it's not really something where small businesses, people who have agile solutions can really fit in very easily. And Clay and others have been working to fix that.
Yes. Harper had a great quote that I'm paraphrasing right now when he came on Twit. That was something along the lines of, you're in trouble when you're trying to build a government website, when the smartest people in the room around those topics are the lawyers. So, you need more technological know-how and muscles around that. And right now the process just makes that far too difficult. Is that right, Patrick?
I think that's right. I mean, it was so bad that the website, we talk about healthcare.gov going down, but the website SAM.gov that runs federal procurement, where everybody registers for federal procurement, went down for a month right around the end of the fiscal year. So this is not a new problem. You have these large IT projects that are almost seem destined to fail. The FBI's, another example is the FBI's virtual case file, which was supposed to stop this information stovepiping after 9/11. And they started work on it right after 9/11, failed multiple times. And they finally got something up 11 years later. I mean, this is what, that's practically the lifetime of Google. So we think about technology and we think about all the great things about how innovation happens. And that is not what technology is actually like in the federal government.
Is there any light at the end of this tunnel? Anything we can look forward to as far as change along these lines?
There have been a number of proposals. I mean, there was a bill actually passed in June by Congressman Issa as part of the DOD authorization that people have said would help fix parts of this. I think that will probably get a second hearing and potentially some modifications now that there's been a huge conversation around this. And there's frankly been, I mean, this idea of, if you talk to folks in the situation, a lot of these are very simple changes about just giving small businesses a chance to actually compete for the contracts. Increasing kind of the limits for like simplified acquisition, removing a few of the filing requirements. People who are actually more expert at this than me think, those small changes might actually make a difference. But right now, the regulation itself is just massive and unwieldy, and it's very difficult for people who are actually good at technology to get in there.
All right. Well, before we leave the topic of legislation and policy, there is a bill pending. We've been talking a lot about net neutrality lately because the Verizon FCC case was recently argued in the D.C. Circuit. It sounds as though this bill, the Consumer Choice in Online Video Act, would sort of make that whole debate irrelevant because it would make it illegal for ISPs to slow down video services and otherwise regulate the traffic coming down their pipes. This is something that Free Press finds encouraging and wants to see move forward. Can you tell us more about it, Josh?
Sure. This is a bill that was just introduced by Rockefeller, and it is a bill that I think is really pro-consumer and pro-competition. And it's a bill that actually tackles some of the issues that Patrick was just talking about in government, but in the private sector. So we've got issues where the biggest cable and internet companies have been able to manipulate the marketplace so that make it really hard for new innovators and new entrants, especially online video entrants, to get a foothold and really expand and compete. And so because they own the pipes and because in many cases like Comcast, they also own the content producers and NBC Universal, it becomes really challenging for new places to kind of get in the door and begin offering really competitive, innovative new products to consumers to help them access video online and over the top through their televisions. So this bill really takes aim at that. And so it tries to stop discrimination, blocking, and other behaviors from the internet service providers and cable companies, and also tries to implement a couple really common sense specific policies that would allow fairness in negotiating with these different companies as well. So it begins to really level the playing field in the video market, which has gotten so consolidated at the very top, and will really allow sort of new entrants to come in. And I'm really excited about the provisions of this bill.
And I probably went too far when I said that if it moves along and passes, it would render irrelevant the FCC-Verizon dispute. There are a lot of issues in play there, but it's certainly in the same general ballpark. Patrick, any thoughts on this net neutrality bill?
I haven't had a chance to study this bill too deeply. I would say that like my general skepticism about things moving through Congress is probably going to apply to this bill. And I think that because of the net neutrality overtones of this, that there is likely to be, likely to be opposition to this. But it's always good to have, I think regardless of the prospect, it's always good to have a conversation about how content distribution works and how it's working right now, and making sure that that continues to be kind of an innovative space. One of the things, I think we have to ask is there a huge market failure happening right now in this space? I mean, we are seeing, Netflix flourishing in the marketplace, often with original content. Now, this bill would actually make it easier for TV content to make its way into online video platforms. But I could almost argue that a lot of we may in the next few months or year or so see HBO go standalone. It seems like consumers are demanding this type of change. And so it's a question of by the time Congress acts, will the online video space have evolved in a better way? By the time this eventually gets considered, if it does at all.
Evan, are you concerned that this bill is so focused on video, and that maybe other kinds of online traffic, if we're going to talk about net neutrality, deserve to be in the mix as well?
I hadn't really thought about it because I haven't grokked the bill either. I've just kind of learned about it from studying up on, to prepare for the show today, and I haven't actually, looked at it and read it. But, mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of that because, the internet doesn't care what the content is. It just knows that it's transporting bits from one place to the other through the series of tubes. I want to make sure I'm talking about this in the appropriately sophisticated way. So, that maybe there is some concern about that. I hadn't looked at it from the angle. The biggest thing I'm, enjoying about this process is the, I guess it's an irony, isn't it, that it's a Rockefeller that's introducing this pro-competition bill.
That is awesome. And well, Beatmaster in IRC says it's pro-consumer and pro-competition. Sounds European, he says. So.
It's also interesting that this bill comes just a couple months after the McCain bill, which was focused on unbundling in the cable market and really letting consumers choose the channels that they want to purchase rather than having to purchase these predetermined bundles from the cable company. So right. There's a lot of energy and a lot of attention right now on the state and the consolidation within the cable and video market. And I think that attention is a good thing no matter what. And I think it's sparking some really useful conversations.
Does anyone here with us today think that this is an area that legislators should keep their mitts off of, that this is something that, you know, once we start trying to pass laws about it, will make the situation worse. What do you think, Evan?
I think this is a perfect example of why administrative law as a concept is a good thing, because Congress ought to, you know, outline the very broadest contours possible in some kind of enabling statute. Then whether it's the FCC or someone else, you know, I'm just talking about this in the abstract. This is certainly nuanced enough that Congress shouldn't be getting down into the, you know, the crevasses of it all and regulating particular technologies down to the, you know, the actual, you know, particular node of it here. But this is something that is important enough because of its effect on the economy and our society and commerce and everything else. I think I said the same thing twice there. You know, that there definitely needs to be some kind of legislative foundation for it, but then, you know, the dirty work has to be done with those who actually know what's going on. The smartest people in the room can't be the lawyers or the politicians in that instance.
And I think, Evan, you'll like this bill because it does that. It really does take a 10,000-foot view of things and then, you know, passes on the next steps really to the Federal Communications Commission and the FTC. So that's good there. I would also say that what I like about this bill is, you know, it's always a little nerve-wracking when Congress gets into making judgments about content. We never really want that. And this bill really does a good job of talking about the systems and creating a level playing field for all content. And that's really important because obviously we don't want the Congress to be making judgment calls about what's good content and what's not good content.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about my point, Josh, that it's so focused on video and doesn't really take into account throttling other traffic?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the reasons why I would hesitate to call this a net neutrality bill. I think that this does a lot of good things in the spirit of net neutrality, but I don't think that this solves all of our problems, and that if we're really committed to creating a level playing field and making sure there isn't discrimination online, that we need to continue to work towards that goal.
All right. Well, you told me in email, you reminded me that FCC head Tom Wheeler has taken the wheel. And I think what you were telling me is that he's just had his first official act as head of the FCC?
Yeah, he moderated his first meeting this week. And I think that, you know, one of the first things he did was to open up the broadcast marketplace to more investment from foreign entities, which is a very sort of new idea that we would let foreign entities invest in our sort of public airwaves. So that's been a bit controversial, but I think I'm encouraged by some of the statements he's been making. There's not a lot of action to judge him by yet, but the statements he's making, you know, this week, he called himself an advocate for the public. And I don't think we've heard that kind of language from a sitting FCC chairman in a long time, really saying that he wants to be an advocate for the public, but that he also wants to be very much pro-competition. And he thinks we can solve a lot of our issues if we truly have a competitive marketplace that gives consumers real choice, which obviously we don't have in the wireless or wired marketplace right now.
So he is also pro-consumer and pro-competition. So he too must be European, ergo.
Or a Rockefeller.
Yes, or a Rockefeller. He did a nice interview with Ina Fried over at All Things D, where she was trying to pin him down on net neutrality. He was a little bit didn't want to make specific statements about that. The most specific he got was, "I am pro the ability of individuals to access an open network." So that sounds
that's helpful.
Pretty, yes, exactly. So definitely worth checking out that interview. He also seems to be trying to distance himself by talking about how long it has been since he was involved in the early days of cable television and after that in wireless. And so he doesn't, you know, want to be associated with, it sounds like, some of the more broadcast and corporate positions he's had in the past. So, like you say, Josh, it's good that he says that he wants to be a representative of the people. I guess that's part of your job when you're FCC chairman, but it's nice to hear that said with specificity. Patrick, any thoughts on Tom Wheeler?
Not that many. I mean, honestly, I mean, I think that he's done a good job so far, and I think that there has been, generally speaking, I mean, pretty good bipartisan support for his nomination. So I'm interested to see what he's going to do.
Yep, me too. All right, well, let's move on to some more journalistic kinds of considerations. We were touching on that in our WikiLeaks discussion. But over at Free Press, you guys have been shedding a lot of light on the notion that journalists should not be subjected to criminal prosecution for simply doing their jobs. Can you sort of tell us what's going on and what we should be concerned about in that area, Josh?
Sure. And over the past year, we've really seen some troubling cases where, attacks and persecution of leaks, which has been a sort of landmark of the Obama Justice Department, is going after leakers and whistleblowers, has spilled over into threats and attacks and intimidation on the press. And so we're really concerned about that and about how that chills speech and chills freedom of the press. And so, you know, it's things like the Department of Justice secretly seizing 20 phone lines, records from 20 phone lines from the Associated Press, including the AP phone in the U.S. House of Representatives, and seizing those phone records so they saw everyone who they've been calling. And then also in a separate case, another leak investigation, the Justice Department identified a Fox News reporter as an aider and abettor to the leak investigation, saying to the leak itself, saying that in the process of talking to a source, this journalist was then labeled as somebody who helped make that leak possible or was cause for that leak. And so there's, in language like that and in actions like that, we're seeing a troubling trend. And for the most part, it was just sort of one case after another, and we weren't really sure what it added up to. But just last month, the Committee to Protect Journalists, which is one of the world's sort of premier organizations working on journalists and press freedom issues around the world, did their first ever report on freedom of the press here in the U.S. and really went through everything from how the Obama administration uses its own media to circumvent tough questions from journalists all the way through to mass surveillance in the NSA and these actions by the Justice Department, crackdowns on leaks and freedom of information. And the picture that it paints when you all add it up together is troubling. And people like Len Downey, the former executive editor of the Washington Post, say that this is the most threatening and most difficult Washington, D.C. environment for the press that he's ever seen, in times even worse than, you know, working within the Nixon administration, which was quite adversarial to the press. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to raise public awareness about these issues, not only because they affect journalists and that journalists have a profound role in our democracy, but also because increasingly, as more and more people take up the tools of journalism, they too obviously are protected under the First Amendment, but we don't always see people embracing or acknowledging their own rights. And so what we're trying to do is to make the case that all acts of journalism need to be protected and that we need people, everyday people around the U.S. to understand both their rights under the First Amendment, but also to defend the rights of journalists as well.
So are you aware of anyone? Obviously, we know that Glenn Greenwald is not in the U.S. and there are other journalists who are taking a stand saying, you know, we're going to do our journalism from outside the U.S. because we're not willing to accept the consequences of what might happen if we return. Do you know of anyone who has been prosecuted journalistically in Evan? This strikes me as sort of a parallel to in copyright law, saying that they're inducing infringement, that they're inducing the leak or aiding and abetting, as Josh said, an illegal act rather than committing one, but then somehow being pulled into the liability around the illegal act. Josh, are there concrete instances of journalists getting prosecuted?
Well, you know, there's cases like Barrett Brown, who posted a link on a website that went to a bunch of leaked information and private information. He had no role that we know of in actually, you know, hacking into the system that got that private information or posting it online. He simply posted a link to it. You know, he's somebody who's written for Vanity Fair and Huffington Post and others. And he also has had a long history with the group Anonymous, who I think was the source of this information. And so he posted a link to that, and he's being prosecuted for that under the CFFA, the same law that was used to prosecute Aaron Swartz. And so we're seeing cases like that, which is different, I think, than what you're saying. There is language within the Espionage Act that could, you know, criminalize journalists who do publish leaks. That hasn't been used explicitly yet, but we have seen the Espionage Act be used in a number of ways, all the way back to Daniel Ellsberg when he leaked the Pentagon Papers, but all the way up now to Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning. And so there's these cases that are hinging awfully close to that. I think, you know, over in the UK, what we're witnessing is David Miranda, who was hired by The Guardian on contract to deliver documents between Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, who've been doing this reporting for The Guardian. He is, of course, Glenn Greenwald's partner, and he is being charged under – he's not being charged yet, but the government is – asserting that he has broken both espionage and terrorism laws in the UK by carrying these documents that were leaked by Edward Snowden. And at the same time, we see General Alexander, the head of the NSA, saying publicly in an interview that we need to stop reporters from reporting on NSA documents and that the courts and Congress should find some way to stop this reporting from happening. So there's a troubling chill in the air, I would say, but we haven't seen prosecution yet.
All right. Evan, it's pretty funny. I mean, none of this is really funny, but it's, you know, ironic, I guess, that David Miranda was detained at Heathrow just given his last name. You know, it's a whole different form of Miranda kind of situation, I guess. What do you think about all this? And he Evan appears to be,
frozen, so.
Evan appears to be pondering deeply what's going on here. How about you, Patrick?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, that, you know, obviously there's sort of a very practical issue here about the border crossing, right? And obviously that there is probably some level of public objection to, you know, the government going after journalists in the, you know, literally knocking on their doors and forcing them to surrender documents. Yeah. But when they cross the border back into the United States, or in Miranda's case at Heathrow, there is just a much lower standard for whether you can be searched without reason. And that's a standard that has been, you know, upheld, that dates back to the first Congress and that has been upheld time and time again in the courts, including on First Amendment grounds, because, yes, you know, the reasoning being that, you know, terrorist writings or things of that nature are inherently expressive. And so we have to be able to search that at the border. It would be very interesting if there were a case, and I don't know if there has been or not, relating specifically to freedom of the press. But it's been kind of discussed that this border search dynamic of, you know, obviously when you have reporting going on in multiple countries, that this is sort of a weak spot in the system where you don't have to necessarily get a warrant, or there is sort of an expectation that there's less privacy in those types of situations. So it'll be very interesting to see if that gets tested further.
Well, Patrick, that's a great point. And, you know, Janine Gibson, the editor for the U.S. Guardian, the website that's been publishing most of the NSA leaks and information, she said at a conference recently, you know, we can't talk on the phone anymore. We can't email anymore. So we have to literally put our reporters on planes and fly them around the world. And now we're seeing a situation where even that becomes sort of endangered. And we saw, you know, earlier before the NSA leaks, Laura Poitras, the documentary filmmaker who's been working with Glenn Greenwald, she had been stopped more than 40 times at the U.S. border and had her electronics searched. And we come back around to where we started this conversation today, which is the secrecy. And she has tried through FOIA requests, through writing to her members of Congress, through seeking out interviews with Department of Homeland Security to find out why she was stopped and detained. And she's been stonewalled at every step of the way. And now if you fast forward to today, for the last 4 weeks or so, on the media, the public radio program, one of their producers was stopped entering in from Toronto into Buffalo here in the U.S. and had her electronics searched. And she and the producers for On the Media have now been trying for 4 weeks to get answers to why this happened and to have some sort of accountability about this. And they've been stonewalled at every account, every time. So we have this situation where it's, you know, again, this lack of transparency and this lack of accountability where we can't even get answers to these fundamental questions of why this is happening, let alone is it right that it's happening.
Yeah. Evan, did you notice in the reporting around David Miranda that it's reported he was made to turn over his social media passwords under threat of imprisonment, which goes right to what we've been talking about, I think just on the last episode of the show and rather frequently on the show, you know, under what circumstances can you be required to hand those passwords over? And the EFF and others have been very adamant that the Fifth Amendment would protect you from having to disclose those passwords because you are giving up your right to not incriminate yourself. In this circumstance where, you know, you're talking about a journalist, how do you think that shades the Fifth Amendment analysis? They're not, you know, being accused of a crime in a border crossing situation.
Well, I mean, it looks like there would be... If the state of reality is that you could compel a journalist at the border of the U.S. to turn over that information so that the government can get in and search it, it looks like three amendments of the Bill of Rights, 30% of the Bill of Rights is at issue here.
Yes.
You've got the Fifth Amendment one, the Fourth Amendment, you know, the reasonableness of the search and seizure, which I, you know, I want to say a few things about that. And then the First Amendment and all of the you know, good things about the First Amendment that protect the members of the media and the press. So, you know, so there's three layers to peel back if the government were to be so unreasonable and oppressive. You know, I just, you know, it's like this when we talk about border searches, and I'm so glad you're here, Josh, because I want to get your thoughts on this. This is, I'm looking for a kind of a basic constitutional law instruction on this. We talk about the constitutionality under the Fourth Amendment of border searches as if it's a fait accompli. Like there's no issue that it's constitutional. It's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment for the authorities to search when people come into the country. And you know, in the limited amount of research I've been able to do, that it looks like historically that's because there's an interest in making sure there's no contraband being brought in from other countries. You know, drugs would be the obvious one, or weapons or something like that. You know, U.S. citizens, though, coming back into their country don't get to enjoy the freedoms of the Fourth Amendment when you're at the border just because. And it seems like there's no serious debate about that anymore other than, you know, in circles where, you know, where you're operating, Josh. But, you know, why is it that there can't be more discussion about that, like that whether it truly is a inviolate, and that's not the word I'm looking for, you know, unequivocal. Why is it that the courts operate under this unequivocal conclusion that border searches are constitutional under the Fourth Amendment? You don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy for that search to take place. That troubles me. It seems like it's something we ought to rethink.
I think there's definitely a conversation to be had there, but I also think there's this real complexity around, I mean, the borders amplify a sense of, you know, questions about safety, questions about security, in a way that's even more profound than the abstractness of mass surveillance under the NSA. I think people feel that very directly as they're passing through the border. Questions about, you know, how safe are they and how safe is their nation with all these people coming through. And so I do think that part of the reason we haven't had the kind of discussion that you might be suggesting is simply because people feel like at the border, there is a reasonableness to that. And let's be clear, I think both in the case of surveillance and in the case of border searches and NSA stuff, we do need to have reasonableness be part of it. I would never suggest that we should stop all of the NSA's activities, or should we should stop doing any searches at all at the border. But I do think that given the nature of how information travels now, we need to be conscientious about how these precedents impact us on our daily lives, you know, and rules and laws that made sense when we were carrying paper and documents across the border might be different when we're carrying thumb drives and cell phones that carry our documents. And so an interesting note on the being compelled to give your password. I read a essay about the new iPhone 5S and how you actually might have less protection under the Fifth Amendment because of your thumbprint than you would of a password. I don't know, Evan, if you've had thoughts about that or if you've looked into that at all.
Well, yeah, that is interesting because it's not the testimonial act that the Fifth Amendment seems to protect, not the contents of your mind. And I know that we've had some conversations about that. And so, it still seems like there ought to be a Fourth Amendment concern there. I'm not going to say Fourth Amendment right, because I think there's probably no Fourth Amendment protection, for them to search and seize your fingerprints. That seems like something there. I guess, the issue that, what's troubling me about this, and maybe I'm just representing the very question that you're spending so much good effort on Josh, is, I mean, there's something obviously really wacky going on here if Laura Poitras has been stopped 40 times. And it's wacky under the system that's established, the rationale for there being no constitutional protection for a border search. She's and who knows, maybe she is suspected of carrying drugs. Evidently, she can't find out herself. I mean, the reason she's being stopped is because she's Laura Poitras, right? But what's the real answer to that? It just seems to go against there's something clearly going on here that doesn't line up with the stated purpose for lack of constitutional protections at the border that the case law has articulated at least since the 80s. I mean, how long? I mean, I know that there's that case from 1985, a Supreme Court case about border searches. I'm sure it goes back further than that. Yeah, I mean, I think the doctrine goes back all the way back to the late 1700s, right?
Well, so we've got, I think to your point, it is time for that conversation, and I'm hopeful. We've had 78,000 people now contact the Department of Justice about this issue of journalists' rights, and I would say everyone's rights at the border. And Representative Alan Grayson has also written a letter to the Justice Department trying to raise these concerns and seems committed to actually bringing this up at a hearing as well. So my hope is that we can begin to open up that conversation a little bit more. I'll note that it's, of course, also not at the border. There was just this case of a Washington Times journalist who had her home searched under the pretense of looking for a potato gun, but then had her journalistic notes and sources confiscated, which she wasn't made aware of until later on when they were returned to her. And these were, notes of hers from stories she had done that had, details of confidential sources that she was keeping in there and that she was very concerned with. So across the board, we're seeing a bizarre disregard for some of these fundamental issues when it comes to press freedom, and a sense that there's just an imbalance in how our culture and our law is approaching press freedom issues.
The most interesting thing that you said in that one was a potato gun. Seriously?
That was the pretense.
Wow.
Google searching for a potato gun here. Oh, that's interesting. Yes. I want one of those.
Hey, Josh, while Evan searches, I'm curious how useful you think or non-useful the global entry program that's available to U.S. citizens and I guess also some limited other citizens of other countries. It says here the Netherlands, and also Mexico may apply for this program called Global Entry that only helps you out if you are entering the United States. And what it does is streamline your way through customs. I've seen it in action. We were traveling back from Mexico with a friend of ours who's an American Airlines pilot. He has global entry. He's gone through an interview process and been vetted and approved for this program. And rather than having to stop at the customs desk and answer the traditional questions, you've already done a lengthy interview. And what you do instead is go to a kiosk and put your hand on it. I think they take a whole handprint to prove you are who you say you are. And basically, it's just a very quick process and you're immediately let into the country. They do qualify it by saying, that the goal is to speed travelers through the process, but members may be selected for further examination. You know, they're not giving you any guarantee that you're not going to be stopped and searched further. But it does seem to really streamline things. And I'm wondering, from a journalist standpoint, if having to put yourself in a travel database like this, first of all, would even be acceptable? And secondly, if you think that journalists would even be approved for the program?
Whether journalists would be approved for the program is, I think, one of the most interesting questions. I would love to see a test case there. And without having gone through the process myself to apply and to get approved, I don't know the level of your own personal data and information and biometric information that you actually have to give up to become labeled safe. So it may be that many journalists don't feel comfortable giving up that much information already and would rather go through the process and sort of roll the dice with the normal border entry with the hopes that they don't want to disclose that much in advance. So yet to be determined. I'd be really interested. I'll have to start asking around at journalism conferences if anyone's signed up for that. You know, I think increasingly what we're seeing, and I don't think that this is a reflection on border security so much as the economics of the news industry right now, is that a lot of the people doing foreign reporting and international reporting are staying abroad, or sometimes they're freelancers who just hop country to country, and sometimes they are sort of long-term folks who are living in China or Europe overseas for extended periods of time and have made their homes there. So we're not seeing as much flying people around. Now, if Janine Gibson at The Guardian is right, and with the level of surveillance we have, people don't feel confident communicating with sources and really are flying all over the globe again, we'll have to see how that plays into something like this.
Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think it strikes me that this is probably not going to be that helpful at all, just given the caveat in there, and that if the government wants to stop you, it will stop you. And I think, like, particularly in these high profile national security cases. And so I think, I think for those of us who are, I don't necessarily include myself among them, but this might be useful for those audience members who are, frequent international travelers. But it seems like the government's still going to find a way, whether through that initial interview process or through just, carving out an exception each time you cross the border to get the information it wants out of you.
Yeah. Well, I'll let folks know I'm enrolled to be, screened and see if I'm eligible to be in the program. I have my interview in January. And, I don't know if I qualify as a journalist, Josh, to be your test case for journalists. Certainly I don't, to the extent I am. We talk about NSA issues, but I don't directly cover them or break news about them. And I'm in that sort of interesting boat of, am I a lawyer or am I a journalist? That another story in our lineup today brings to the fore, near and dear to Evan's and my heart for a long time, is the SCOTUS blog, which is, has been since very early on in the world of blogging, the go-to source for information on the Supreme Court and its decisions. They're now jockeying with trying to determine whether, there's this very interesting piece in the USA Today discussing how SCOTUS blog reports on arguments and things that it attends at the Supreme Court, and how they aren't given press room access, but they are given lawyer access because they're lawyers and they have, their own ability to attend and be in areas of the court. But rather than writing things up in the press room, they'll be doing it from the cafeteria because they don't have access to that particular part. I guess now, although it's worked for them up until now, they're asking for press credentials for their reporters teeing up the site for a sale eventually. So, and also just as a test case. And the Supreme Court has kind of punted on this, saying, well, we're reevaluating all of our press credentialing rules and guidelines, and we'll get back to you. You know, we're not going to make any decisions until we go through those rules. But Josh, I thought you'd think this was interesting, this whole dichotomy, especially given your push toward identifying acts of journalism, that at the Supreme Court there may be this sort of artificial line drawn between what SCOTUS Blog does, which I definitely consider journalism, and what, you know, the New York Times does.
Yeah, and the SCOTUS Blog case is such a fascinating one, but it's not unique. In fact, we've been working since 2009 with some online and nonprofit news organizations that are very journalistic. Journalism is their mission. These aren't advocacy groups who have journalism, you know, outlets hooked onto them. These are journalism organizations who have been blocked from the Senate and House press galleries. And what we found was that there's old guidelines in place in the Senate press gallery that just really discriminate against the way that new forms of journalism are emerging. So it says things like the majority of your funding has to come from advertising, and it privileges print over other forms of publishing. And now this was back in 2009 when I was working most closely with the Senate on this. And Senator John Kerry actually said at a hearing on the future of journalism that this was something that had to be addressed. Now, last year or earlier this year, the SCOTUS blog actually got Senate press credentials, but even that had taken a long time. And they're still, as you said, held up at the Supreme Court where they do their actual reporting. So it's a really interesting case and one that resonates with people around the country. You know, in Minnesota, there was a small citizen journalism outlet that was trying to cover the State House in Minnesota. Gavel to gavel was trying to do like 100% transparency reporting and get everything out to people on video, streaming live. And they were being forced out of the state house because they weren't seen as legitimate. And so this is a battle that's playing itself out as people come to understand the fundamental shifts in journalism that are happening and that news and information is being given to the public in new ways. But we have to account for these kinds of new players if they're there trying to do genuine public interest journalism, to discriminate against them in a realm and a place where we actually need as much coverage as possible in sort of our courts and our government is really problematic.
Patrick, I think I saw this in your Twitter feed. Do you have any thoughts on SCOTUS Blog and their bid to be credentialed journalists?
I don't think it stopped them from doing actually better reporting than most mainstream outlets. I mean, yeah. You know, I don't think it stopped them from being effective. I mean, I remember the ruling on the Affordable Care Act and how, you know, every single news outlet got it wrong. You know, they literally said, the court said one thing, it said the complete opposite of that, because they were literally reading through page by page and they seemed to think that they were saying, and they jumped on that. And you had CNN announcing that, you know, the Affordable Care Act had been overturned. Mm-hmm. And then you had, you know, everyone's like, you know, in SCOTUS blog and listening to the kind of the clickety clack of their, you know, cover it live widget, and saying, hold on, people, we're still waiting to see what's going on here, reading through page three, page four. Okay, it's upheld. And they got it right. And so, you know, it really shows technology has not been a barrier, and these newer outlets have not been, you know, oftentimes uphold higher journalistic integrity than some of the traditional outlets that get credentialed all the time.
Well, that's a really interesting point that it hasn't held them back. It may have helped them. There have certainly been situations where I've had access to legal proceedings that I think I probably would not have had access to if I were there on a press credential. I had access because I had my state bar credential. So, you know, I do think it's a really interesting confusion of the roles that is brought about by the fact that everyone has a voice and a way to get news out there. You know, as Free Press points out, defining journalism becomes really important and really difficult in the modern era. I'm sorry, Josh, I cut you off.
No, that's a great point. And I think that where I get concerned about is less in the case-by-case basis, because as Patrick points out, SCOTUS Blog is doing great work, whether they have formal access or not. But what I'm interested in and concerned about is the precedent that's being set. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to be really careful, whether it's in press credentialing laws or access to the SHIELD law that's being debated right now, or even things like anti-SLAPP legislation that's, some states have that would protect journalists from frivolous lawsuits against public participation. I think all across all these different issues, we need to look at how the precedent can end up discriminating against who can be considered as eligible for these things. And luckily, through a lot of negotiation, the SHIELD law has gotten to a place that's pretty good. I don't love details of it, but it is literally the best SHIELD law we've had, and still has really unfortunate things like a terrible national security carve out that leaves a lot of national security journalists uncovered and unprotected by this. But in terms of how it defines a journalist, it uses sort of a judicial discretion loophole that, and I say loophole in the best way this time, that would actually help protect a lot of journalists that are non-traditional, that are kind of working in this space. So that question about how these new laws that are being written, can they, in a media ecosystem and technology ecosystem that's moving so quickly, how can we make sure that our policies don't actually impede those changes and those innovations, I think is really important, and something I know Patrick thinks a lot about.
All right, well, let's make SCOTUS Blog our second MCLE passphrase for this episode. And just real quickly, because it is big news, I want to tell you guys, or make sure we touch on an important copyright story before we start to get to our tip and resource of the week. So, Evan, we've been bantering about the Google Books case, the Google Books search case, since 2005. Actually, our show started in 2006, so it was already underway before we even were doing this show. But it has finally come to its first legal decision, its first definitive determination here at the district court level. U.S. District Court Judge Denny Chin has actually ruled in Google's favor on the book search case and held that its scanning and making snippets available is fair use. So on to the Second Circuit Court of Appeal. But right. Google wins round one and wins it big.
Right. And I mean, it's so interesting that it's taken 8 years to finally get a decision on the merits on the question of fair use. And for a lot of the intervening period of time between September of 2005 and now when this Authors Guild lawsuit was filed, we thought the case had settled. You know, it was on the 10th anniversary of the DMCA, October 28th, 2008, that they announced that they'd settled it. And so that was mm-hmm. this huge deal. And then there was all the different iterations of efforts to settle, which brought in antitrust concerns. And I mean, we've spent a lot of airtime talking about those issues that had nothing to do with the merits of the case. So here we have an order from Judge Chin talking about the fair use factors, and amazingly enough, I mean, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back here, saying I was all prescient or anything, because this is just it was always been a pretty straightforward fair use analysis on this. But I put up a tweet last night, a link to an MP3 file for the podcast that I was doing way back in 2005 in connection with my blog. It was the audio from a panel discussion that I was on November 29th, 2005, just a few weeks after the case had been filed. And again, I'm not trying to boast and say that I was looking into the future here. I was just looking at the fair use factors. And it's taken 8 years and untold.
No, it's good. I'm glad you're pointing it out. We've razzed you way too much about saying Bitcoin would not be around for another year. So good that you were right on this one.
Right. Yeah. Whew, thanks. Yeah. I can actually have some credibility. Yes. So
invite Professor James Grimmelman back on the show. I hope that he will come. It will probably not be until early next year to really get down into the nitty gritty of this case and where it might go next. But I wanted to let people know in case they had not seen that round one goes to Google. So let us, we have some good resources and a tip to give you before we are out of here. The first, Josh referenced, and that is SecureDrop, which is a way, as Josh mentioned, for news gathering organizations to securely and in secret have information provided to them from sources. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about it and how people can implement it, Josh?
Sure. So it's an open source project. It's, you know, sort of designed for newsrooms, but really available for anybody. And the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which can be found at pressfreedomfoundation.org, has all the documentation on it. It's got very detailed documentation for how to install it. It's all the code is on GitHub, and we are still encouraging people to come and help us improve it. It went through a security audit before we took over the code, and it had some problems with it. And we've addressed 90% of those problems. And the people who did the security audit have actually come back and said that they're quite happy with where it is now. So it really is, you know, nothing can be 100% secure. But this is a really good option if you're trying to have anonymous conversations with sources, or in terms of the law community, probably, you know, with clients is another way it could be used. So I encourage you to check it out. Reach out to me, you know, on Twitter or via email, or the folks at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. We'd all be happy to help you get that up and running.
Right. And folks who are longtime listeners or viewers of This Week in Law are familiar with the Freedom of the Press Foundation. We've had its co-founder and executive director, Trevor Tim, on the show many times, and hopefully many times in the future. So definitely go check that out. I also wanted to point people toward the EFF's guide for travelers carrying digital devices. EFF has always been great on giving guidelines for this kind of situation. With our talk about border search and what to do if access to your digital device is being requested, this guide is really invaluable. It talks about why your devices can be searched at the border, how to protect your data, deciding how to protect your data, basic precautions you can take, using backups, minimizing the data you carry, and basically how to deal with that whole situation should you find yourself in it. So if you have questions about that, again, everything that we've discussed today, all the stories we've considered in more depth, and these resources and tips are going to be available to you at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/236 for all the URLs. So definitely bookmark that one. And then our tip this week, yes.
I'll just say that the EFF guide is fantastic, but it's a little bit dated, and I know they're updating it now and we'll have a new version soon. So keep an eye out for that.
We definitely will. Our tip this week is sort of lighthearted and hopefully obvious. Lil' Kim got herself in trouble with a Redditor and also an Instagram user for taking an image from for her song Dead Gal Walking from somebody's Instagram feed. Of course, in the age of the internet, that's not going to go be let go in a quiet way. So Samantha is the Reddit user, went very public with it, said this is her image, is going to not let Lil' Kim just go ahead and lift it without attribution. It's not, you know, it doesn't appear to have even been Creative Commons licensed in any way. It was just kind of lifted and used because it's kind of a cool image, but was not asked for permission and no authorization was given. So it's a good lesson to anyone involved in digital strategy, Patrick, isn't it? That you don't just lift images off of something like Instagram.
That is absolutely right.
Yes. All right, guys, this has been such a fun discussion. Really a lot of interesting ground that we've covered. Josh, anything in particular you want to point people towards or events you want to plug before we go ahead and get out of here?
If any of you are in the DC area, we're going to be doing an event at the National Press Club on December 12th that looks at violence and intimidation against journalists. We'll be screening an amazing documentary called Killing the Messenger there. And I encourage all of you to come by and let's continue this conversation there, if not before.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Josh. It's been really fun chatting with you, and you too, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks, Denise.
Anything you want to let us know to look out for coming down the pipe?
Sure. I would just point people to the book. Obviously this was a book that kind of came up, like we kind of decided to do it like a couple days after the victory. And people can, and it took a little while for it to come to full fruition, but it did come out earlier this year. Contains chapters from Cory Doctorow, Ron Paul, Alexis Ohanian, Larry Lessig, and others, as well as some of the people who were involved, and myself, and a couple guys from Demand Progress, David Moon and David Siegel. And I got to know them real well through Aaron Swartz, who, when we were first in late 2010, talking about the precursor bill to SOPA and PIPA called COICA, shot me an email and said, "Have you seen this? This is terrible. And, can we work together on it?" So I got to know them, David Moon and David Siegel, really well throughout this process. We co-edited the book.
For anyone who doesn't remember that I mentioned it earlier in the show, is Hacking Politics, How Geeks, Progressives, and the Tea Party, Gamers, Anarchists, and Suits Teamed Up to Defeat SOPA and Save the Internet. Available.
That is a mouthful of a title.
Yes.
But
Hacking Politics will do.
Right. And you can order it at bit.ly / Hacking Politics, and there is a Bitcoin purchase option.
Of course there is, because yes. Bitcoin is around for good.
Because sorry. Bitcoin, sure is. Just for the reason alone.
Sorry, Evan. Can't resist. Mm-hmm. Really fun show. Evan, thank you so much, too, for jumping on with us, as usual.
Yes, great time. Great way to spend a Friday afternoon. Really have enjoyed the conversation, and as usual, learned a ton. So yes. Really enjoyed talking, Josh and Patrick. Really nice to meet you. Really enjoy learning about your work, and hope to stay in touch.
Absolutely. Evan, enjoy the football this weekend.
For sure. Go Wabash.
So, folks, we hope that you've enjoyed the show. If you like the show and like other Twitch shows, I encourage you to go over, even if you don't like it. In fact, particularly if you don't like it, go over to twit.tv/survey. And what you're going to find there is our annual audience survey. We want to hear about what you do like, what you don't like, about all of the Twitch shows you listen to. You'll get a list of all those shows. You can check off the ones that you regularly consume. And then let us know what you think. And we certainly want to hear all your feedback about Twill. It will help us make Twit even better. And we thank you so much for your continued support. We thank you if you're joining us live. We record the show at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1900 UTC at twit.tv. But if you can't join us live, you can get us on demand on your own schedule. Go to twit.tv/twill. Our archive of shows is there, in addition to at YouTube at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. Of course, we're on iTunes and Roku and various other ways that you can access podcasts related to entertainment. We'll be in all those outlets for you. So we hope that you will tune in however makes the most sense for you. And after you do, don't let it stop at listening to or watching the show. Get in touch with us. Let us know directly what you think. You can email Evan. He's evan@twit.tv. I'm denise@twit.tv. Or give us a shout on Twitter. He is Internet Cases over there, and I am D Howell. Facebook and Google Plus too are also good places to hit us up. And we just love hearing from you. We love your tips about what we should discuss, what we should have gone further into, who we should have on the show, all that stuff. So please don't forget us as you go through the week. As you see great stories you think that we should pay attention to, do let us know. And again, if you want to see the archive of stuff that we've discussed, we have that Delicious account, This Week in Law on Delicious, with each episode number has all the links to what we've discussed on those shows. So thanks, everyone. It's been really great sharing this time with you, and we will see you next week. Take care.